History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really should not go untold. We've learned that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. And what can we do about it? Well, first of all, we can take a little initiative and ask a few questions. And then invest some time to patiently listen as stories that may have been buried for a long, long time take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Did you know that March 25th is National Medal of Honor Day? We're going to hear from another Medal of Honor recipient soon on Hometown Heroes, but not today. If you'd like to learn more about those who have earned our country's most prestigious military decoration, go to medalofhonorday.com. I have that linked for you also at hometownheroesradio.com. But it's another annual observation that we're going to make the focus of our show today because you'll have a few days to look into events in your area commemorating National Vietnam War Veterans Day. Since 2017, that special day has been marked every year on March 29th. If you go to VietnamWar50th.com, you can search for events in your area. In a bit, we're going to meet a Vietnam veteran sharing his experiences from a half century ago. But one thing Hometown Heroes listeners have learned over the years is that the factors that would eventually lead to the war in Vietnam were unfolding long before America's military officially arrived, and even a decade before the French were forced out of Dien Bien Phu. George Wicks served in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, during World War II, that of course the predecessor to the CIA, and in giving us a snapshot of the OSS's contributions to Allied victory in World War II, Wicks gave us a portrait of the first American casualty in Vietnam, way back in the 1940s.
My commanding officer in Saigon, Peter Dewey, parachuted into France and met up with some resistance. This was all planned. You see, they had communicated beforehand. This is an OSS operation. He and a few others, one of them was the son of Ernest Hemingway, who parachuted in with a fly rod because he was going to live on the trout of France.
Now, what would a modern literature professor know about Ernest Hemingway, though?
You can't help it. Might know too much about Ernest Hemingway. They captured a German staff car and drove around in it, I don't know how they managed this, for a considerable period, sending information back. Now, this is just before the invasion from North Africa, the invasion of southern France. They obtained information about activities on the Rhine, all kinds of information. This is just one little operation.
And this would become your boss, your commanding officer, yes. Dewey. So you're saying that particular mission, one thing that he did and spearheaded, informed the invasion of Europe.
Yes, yes. And that's the kind of intelligence gathering operation that they did during the war. And I've just been reading a book about the invasion, the D-Day, preparation for the D-Day by a French organization that fed information to MI6 in London. They gave them all kinds of information about German submarine bases, for instance, and the development of the rockets in Northern Europe. So this kind of intelligence was terribly important for any large-scale military activity or even small-scale military activity.
Important and also extremely dangerous. And how was it that you came to work with Dewey? When did you first meet him?
I met him in Rangoon. You know, one of the guys in the message center said, there's somebody here who's going to lead the mission to Saigon, and you ought to interview him. So I did. I went to Major Dewey, as he was then. He's always referred to as Colonel Dewey because he became a colonel overnight, the way OSS people did. I became a lieutenant then, you see. I said, I would like to go to Saigon with you. I studied the language. He was unimpressed. He said, yes, but do you know French? And I said, French is my first language. All right, he said, what is the French word for street? So I said, rue. He said, all right, you can go. Turn up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And when I turned up at 3 o'clock in the morning, he pinned lieutenant's bars on me. And then I started impersonating an officer, for which I was cashiered many months later when the Army found out about it.
So your test for promotion was pronouncing one word correctly, and probably a lot of people failed that test.
Well, I don't think he gave that test to very many people. Peter Dewey, who spoke faultless French himself, was looking for French speakers on his mission, and he'd gone all over the theater looking for French speakers, hadn't had much success, because we were going to be dealing with the French in Indochina. So it was essential that some of us at least be able to speak the language.
Well, and I think today, if you just say the word Vietnam, people instantly think of the 60s and maybe the 70s. Folks might go back to the 50s and know about some of the things that happened there. But not too many people realize that all of that was set up by what happened there at the end of World War II. And you were a piece of this. So when you talk about the mission that Dewey was going to be on, what was that mission that you eventually became a part of?
OSS had a mission to Saigon and another to Hanoi to cover what was going on. Now, this was gathering political intelligence rather than military intelligence because there was no State Department representation in all of Southeast Asia, and we were a kind of advanced team sent to report back to Washington on whatever was happening, and also to look after American interests. But I always felt that our chief purpose really was to report on the political situation. And Saigon, for instance, was a hub of intrigue. There were Chinese and Cambodian, and there were all kinds of people, operatives there. It's sort of like a movie set. If you've seen The Quiet American, you have a sense of what, that's a very good, Graham Greene was there 5 months after we were, and he describes it perfectly. Hanoi was under the control of the Vietnamese. They were really, and they were setting up their own government. Ho Chi Minh declared independence from Hanoi. Well, OSS mission in Hanoi was in daily touch with him. They were very close. And one of my friends in the Vietnamese group was in the jungle with Ho while the war was still going on because they were in action against the Japanese, guerrilla action.
And you would have some personal interaction with him as well. What precipitated that, and what was the purpose of your meeting with Ho Chi Minh?
Well, I didn't meet with Ho Chi Minh until later. This is a mission that another guy and I cooked up. I should explain that I spent 4 months in Saigon, and then our commanding officer was killed, and we all were interviewed, signed depositions, and I signed myself, name and rank, and theater headquarters, when it heard this, who is this Lieutenant Wicks? So that's when I was cashiered. And OSS, to save face and my face as well, called me back to our theater headquarters in Singapore, where the commanding officer said, now, where would you like to go next? I can offer you Batavia, Jakarta, or Bangkok. Well, I knew I wanted to go to Bangkok. And so I went to Bangkok for 6 wonderful weeks. I got there in a peculiar fashion. The legation, as it was then, the first State Department representation in Bangkok was beginning. Wasn't anywhere in Vietnam or anywhere else, I think, in Southeast Asia. Anyhow, so they wanted to ship an old Plymouth painted in olive drab camouflage for use by the embassy. No American cars did Bangkok at this time. They loaded it on a freighter, a tramp steamer, and loaded me on too, and that was my mission, to escort this car. Well, tramp steamers are trafficking all along the way. This one stopped off in Saigon, what do you know, for Christmas. And I saw my old friends, one of them and I, cooked up this mission of going to Hanoi. We wanted to go to Hanoi to see what was going on. We sent a message back. He was a major, so he had pull. I sent a message back to OSS Washington about going to Hanoi to interview Ho Chi Minh and see if he was a communist. Well, I mean, everyone, of course, knew that Ho Chi Minh was a communist. In retrospect, I think, because there was no, the OSS mission to Hanoi had ended in October. This is, by this time, we're at the end of December. And I think OSS Washington wanted to know what was going on in Hanoi, this new government forming and all that. So they said, yes, you go to Hanoi and ask Ho Chi Minh if he's a communist, which we did eventually. But I had to go from Bangkok with a radio operator up to Hanoi, and Frank went from Saigon to, well, anyhow, we met up in Hanoi and spent some time there and watched the French arrive in Hanoi in the beginning of the war there, in fact.
Was that the extent of your interview with Ho Chi Minh? Are you a communist? Yes, and see you later?
He said, yes, I'm a communist. Well, the second question was, will your country be communist? Because this is the time when this country, the Cold War, was one of the things that shocked me when I got back to the U.S. after the war, was how hysterical the country was about communism. And that had a lot to do, by the way, with what happened in our relations with Ho Chi Minh.
Well, and I guess that's a question that seems obvious, is here in the 1940s, could you see something coming down the road? Did you have any idea or any inclination that America would end up getting involved in that part of the world because of the way things were going?
No, and it was insane. It was particularly insane after the Vietnamese beat the French army at Dien Bien Phu. You could see that a military campaign such as this country would conduct wouldn't work against a population and an entire population that wanted its independence. We understood a lot of this, but convincing Washington was another matter. We could see a lot of what was coming, and all of us in OSS were sympathetic with the Vietnamese desire for independence.
You won't find the name of A. Peter Dewey on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., because the Defense Department has ruled that war did not begin for the U.S. in Vietnam until November 1955, after the fall of Dien Bien Phu. But Dewey was killed there a decade before that. It was September 26, 1945. George Wicks remembers that time period with incredible clarity.
Peter Dewey was supposed to go home. He, in those days, at the end of the war, if you had enough points, as they called it, enough years, days, actions, whatever, overseas service, you were released for a discharge. He was supposed to go home on a particular day, and the plane didn't turn up in time. So we drove cross-country from the airport to the villa where OSS guys were living, through a roadblock, and by this time there'd been skirmishing on the outskirts of Saigon, and the Vietnamese were armed, through a roadblock which was manned by Vietnamese, armed Vietnamese. Going through this roadblock, Peter Dewey yelled something in French at the Vietnamese. Now, one of our officers had been wounded the night before, and he had just visited that man in the hospital. He may have yelled something. The officer who was riding with him didn't understand French, so he doesn't know what Peter said. Well, the Vietnamese reaction was they had a machine gun, and they killed him, shot his head off. The Jeep overturned, and it's only incredible luck and some skill that allowed Dewey's second-in-command, Blücher, to get to the villa. He was, I don't know the exact distance. Some accounts is 500 yards. I doubt that he would have sprinted 500 yards. He happened to be that thing, which I am not at all, a crack shot with the 45. And he had one, of course, as an officer. So he made it. Then we were, you know, we had a firefight on our hands for several hours. We were able to drive off the attackers. And finally, they raised a white flag. They wanted to collect their injured they wanted to collect their casualties and retire from the field. There were only three of us shooting, I think. But we were trained soldiers. And we were using the weapons we'd been trained with, you know, a carbine. Looks like a nice little thing. I don't know if you've ever fired one, but it's very effective. You don't need a major weapon in a firefight like that. The Vietnamese were not trained as soldiers. They were just a bunch of guys who were opposing French occupation of their country.
By the same token, Master of the Obvious here says your life was in severe danger in that moment. Is that something you lived with all the time or that you had to be prepared for? When a situation like that actually comes up, what's that like to be a part of it?
From the time I went into the Army, and I think this is probably true of many of us, I wondered, first of all, if I was going to survive this war, and then what I would do in combat. This was my only experience of combat. I had been in dangerous situations, but not in actual gunfight. And when it happened, I knew exactly what I had to do. You know, I went up to the front of the property, lay down on the ground, with my carbine, enough ammunition. It was natural. It was sort of almost, I won't say instinctive. I thought it out, and I thought the front of the property is the best place to be. You see most clearly, and lying down on the ground, you don't have the problem of unsteady hands shaking or whatever. So the three of us were able to drive off, I don't know how many attackers, but a number, considerable number, and they had pretty heavy casualties and finally called it off.
And then did you have to get out of there after that because of what had happened?
When the attack began, the officer in charge wanted to send the message to us. Our radio communication was always with OSS headquarters in Ceylon. The broadcasts were made at fixed times and always in code, but in this case, couldn't meet the schedule. They decided, I was not a part of this since I was down there on the ground shooting, but decided not to send messages and couldn't send messages. I was a code guy, so there was nobody to encode the messages. And anyhow, send them in the clear and don't try to raise Ceylon because it's not the time they're listening. So send it to the British instead. And the British sent out a troop of Gurkha, a squad of Gurkhas who appeared, but all the action was over by the time they arrived. One of our officers and a French officer who happened to have been there for lunch that day, but he'd also been in the OSS, interestingly enough. He'd been living in Washington, and he joined the OSS first and then later transferred to the French Army. They went and met with the Vietnamese. They wanted to get the Jeep and Dewey's body. Well, both had disappeared and were never found again.
Well, and you're qualified to say that because you were one of the ones searching for him, right?
One of my jobs, subsequently, one of my assignments was examining grisly remains to see if they were Peter Dewey. So we did that for a time. My point is that Frank White, this same guy I went to Hanoi with, and the French officer, Valger, were perfectly safe by then. You know, I give them a lot of credit for going out there and meeting with the Vietnamese after we had been shooting at each other for several hours. But we could have gone back to town. There wasn't any problem. We would have taken the regular road back to town. We wouldn't have gone through the roadblock. So the Gurkhas didn't save us, but they made us more comfortable.
And what about the emotional impact? Because here's a guy who has been your boss, and now he's gone. How did that hit you as a young man far away from home?
Peter and I were quite close. We used to speak French to each other, which none of the other guys did. We had a kind of standing joke. I would greet him in French as mon colonel, and he would greet me as mon lieutenant. He talked to me quite a bit. Well, for one thing, he told me all about what he was picking up in the way of intelligence. And it was very interesting because he was an old hand, and he was very experienced, had terrific connections, and, as I said, spoke faultless French and got around. In fact, that's why he was being sent away. The British didn't like the fact that he was meeting with Vietnamese, particularly Vietnamese active in the independence movement. He talked to me a lot about personal things. You know, what was I going to do after the war? He was thinking of a career in foreign service. I've always thought if Peter Dewey had lived, I would have gone into the foreign service. So I was quite moved by his death. I felt it personally. This was a friend. This was someone I knew quite well and saw on a daily basis for, it'd been 3 months that we'd been together then.
And did his death affect at all your view of your own life and death or your own future if you were going to continue with the OSS or this intelligence work?
I didn't think I was in any danger after that. I mean, once we got back to the Continental Hotel in the center of Saigon, we went on with our radio communications, and the radio operator and I had our own little place in the annex next to this very sinister character who owned the hotel, Frank Heaney. He was a Corsican who was in the opium business, and he was very friendly. He was always friendly with me because I spoke French. The radio operator didn't. He always invited me to come in and have a pipe with him. It was a real sort of Graham Greene operation, you know. And Graham Greene, when he came to Saigon, soon met up with Frank Heaney and talked with him for hours, fascinated by this man who knew all kinds of underground things, you know, the opium trade and whatnot.
And I'm sorry if any of my questions border on cliche or a generic view or interpretation of things, but did you ever feel like the man who knew too much or could end up knowing too much because of some of these circles you were running in or the things you were exposed to?
I can answer that with a rather melodramatic bit of information. When I went back to Saigon on that tramp steamer, I learned that I'd had a price on my head. Peter Dewey and I had been marked by the French colonials. They knew we were meeting with the Vietnamese, and I didn't explain that. Peter met with some of the leaders of the Vietnamese independence movement. And since he was well known, he decided he couldn't always meet with them, and he asked me to go and have some of these clandestine meetings because I could speak French with them. They all spoke French. They were all educated men. And two or three times I would get dressed. There were lots of POWs floating around town, mostly Dutch, who hadn't been repatriated yet. And they all wore khakis but with baggy shorts. So I dressed up like a Dutch POW, and in order to walk the streets where I wouldn't be seen, well, the French obviously were on to us, and that's why they had put a price on Peter's head and mine. And they were not very well informed, however. The description of me was really a description of Peter Dewey. He was about 6 inches shorter than me and slightly bald.
Details matter, don't they? Not only did George Wicks make it home, he would go on to a long career as a professor at the University of Oregon. You can find his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Who knew? The first American casualty in Vietnam came way back in 1945. But if you visit Washington, D.C. today, of course, you'll find more than 58,000 names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall. When we come back, a story we've never heard before from a man who, like so many Vietnam veterans, had some names that he needed to see on that wall. Friends of his who did not make it home. National Vietnam War Veterans Day is coming up March 29th. Maybe you can attend an event in your area. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode preparing you for National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. Every Vietnam veteran has a story, but it might not be too easy to tell that story. Almost every Vietnam veteran also has a connection to at least one of those 58,000 names etched in granite in Washington, D.C. And as we're about to hear, Gene Gio of Santa Cruz, California, is no exception. He served in the 8th of the 4th, the 8th Battalion, 4th Field Artillery in Vietnam. But let's go back to well before that. What was Santa Cruz like when you were growing up?
It's completely different than it is now. It was a more conservative type of town. I used to be able to take my shotgun, put it over my shoulder, ride on my bike down Seaside Street to Antonelli's Pond and shoot a limited dove after school.
After school?
After school, so you wouldn't be able to do that anymore now.
And you said you grew up in a fishing family?
My father's side of the family were fishermen. My mother's side were Brussels sprout ranchers up the coast.
So did you spend a lot of time out in Monterey Bay as a kid?
I did, both sport fishing and commercial fishing. Even before I did it, when I did it for commercially, I'd just go out on the boat with my father.
Any unique experiences out there on the boat?
A lot of unique ones, but I guess I can tell you about the day that I decided not to be a fisherman. And we had been fishing squid all the whole time from May 12th when I got back from Vietnam until into October. and then we switched to anchovies. Behind the boat, we towed a barge that we put the fish in. The barge held anywhere, depending on how dry they were, up to 26 ton. Well, we were fishing anchovies on a 20-ton limit, and we come in, we unload, we're done, and I'm in the bottom of the barge cleaning it out, and my cousin leans over and asks me, how many ton do you think we had? And I say, I don't give a blank blank. We're only going to get paid for 20. He said, we got 16 and a half. I said, well, we got more than that. And he said, no, there was a hole in the hopper. They all went out. And I look over the side of the barge, and all of Moss Landing is covered with anchovies. And so my father was back on the boat. There were six of us instead of five. And so I just went to the helm, drove the boat, tied it up, got my oilskins, and walked off the boat. My father and my uncle were partners. My uncle goes, where are you going? I says, well, we got six guys. You only need five. So I'm taking a vacation that I was going to take when I got home from Vietnam and had to come out here. So that was my last day of fishing.
Well, tell me about, you know, before Vietnam, before you got drafted, I'm sure you had some plans for yourself. What kind of plans did you have?
I was going to college to be an engineer. I'd fish. I'd go to school 9 months a year on a deferment, but I'd have to make it through the summer where I'd go fishing, and I was pretty handsomely paid. So after my third year of college, I got drafted. And so I went to the owner of the cannery. I should tell him what happened, and this is really true. It was hard for in the summer months to get help. And so I had him write a letter to the draft board. Please don't draft Eugene Guillo, because if you do, the five on the boat and the 50 that work for the cannery are all going on unemployment. The lady at the draft board goes, you got away from me this year, but I'm going to get you next year. And so the next year came around, which was 69, and doing the same thing. I'm on the boat, and I'm going out the back door to buy some mag rims for my car. My mother says, hey, you got a letter from the draft board. Maybe you ought to read it before you go. And sure enough, I got drafted. And I had already appealed to Sacramento and San Francisco and everything. So I knew I was gone.
You had 1 year of college left, and they said, sorry, you can't finish on it.
San Jose State. I didn't graduate in four, so I was going to take a fifth year.
Can you help us understand? Because, you know, today's young people, they're still registering with the Selective Service, but there's no draft. We haven't had a draft in a long time. How did that impact you emotionally to get that kind of news?
Well, see, all the friends of mine went in the service mostly directly out of high school. So they had been in and came back before I went in. So I had a lot of preparation from them, both mentally and being prepared what to do when you did get drafted. So I was pretty much prepared mentally for it. I knew it was inevitable.
Tell me how that unfolded from there. You get drafted and then what?
So I go to basic training in Fort Lewis. And when I was in basic training, I guess they got a way of kind of spotting who has a little bit of, can do math or whatever. And they were trying to get me to go to officer candidate school. But to do that, you had to sign up for an extra year, and I would not do that. So instead of that, luck would have it, like you say, best plans of God are better than the plans of me.
Yeah.
I got sent to NCO school. So I was taking courses alongside. Well, first we went to AIT, and then I was taking courses with the same people that I had taken AIT with. But they were becoming officers, and I was going to NCO school. And then a couple other events happened. I did not graduate from NCO school, so I got held behind and taught fire direction control until I got just down to a year. And if you got less than a year, they wouldn't send you to Vietnam. They waited right till about the last day. I got my orders for Vietnam and went to Vietnam. As far as what happened, why I didn't graduate, me and five other people wrote a letter about a Major Brown. It was the last day, and we had taken tactics courses, and these two second lieutenants said, well, if you want to write any in your evaluation critique of anybody you had, yeah, well, Major Brown is terrible instructor. Major Brown does more harm than good. He's doing something about barbed wire around your neck, and yeah. And so we were out training, I guess, the next week. This helicopter comes in and says, and calls out six of us, and we got to go back to base. And we're told, well, you guys haven't been in the Army 6 months. This guy's been in there 60 whatever years, you know, and you have no right to. So we didn't graduate. Instead of come out Spec 5, we came out Spec 4. Then I stood there, taught fire direction control till, like I say, right before we went to Vietnam. Toward, I guess it was like either the 28th or 29th of June, 1970.
Well, and how'd you really feel about that? What did that mean to you, knowing that you were going to be sent over there?
I guess I didn't have that much feelings about it. I was pretty up for it and really ready for the challenge, not unlike a lot of other people that were scared of going and didn't want to spend 2 years of their life and take the chance of dying and the rest of it. So, and it was the same way the whole time I was there until a couple of events happened and I knew that we weren't going to win that war.
Well, sounds like those are a couple of events that we need to hear about. Was there anything you need to share before that, or you want to dive right into that?
I get to Vietnam, and I've had all my friends tell me about this, and you don't volunteer for anything. And so I kind of stood in the back. I was in fire direction control, and because they needed someone to go out to Charlie Battery that understood and could do fire direction control, because most of the people came off the guns. Mm-hmm. And so this guy, and he's Italian like me, Tony Scanelli, says, "Oh yeah, come out here, you know. It's nothing, you don't have to worry about how you dress or anything," which is true. And then they were pushing me back there that they needed someone up there and I'd be able to shoot the guns and all that. And so I went. And the very first Sunday that I was out at Charlie Battery, which is on Conti and Alpha 4, 1,500 meters from the DMZ, we come under rocket attack. And then mortar attack. And we had this, there was this ridge, and they're teaching me about it, and where they shoot at us, but it's about 5,000 meters away, and they're not very accurate. So we were up on top of the FDC bunker trying to see where they were coming from. And they walk rounds all around the battery, and a couple of people got killed that day. And we had no communications with the guns because all the wires were down. And we had where we thought we should be shooting. And so they needed people to go down to the gun to shoot it directly there versus doing it with communications. And I went running down to gun 4, and there's this other guy running back to gun 4 behind me. A rocket went off in between us. I got hit in the back. I thought I was dead. But instead of shrapnel, it was dirt clods. And then so after everything cooled down, we had a smart motor pool guy, and he realized that if a rocket comes in by sticking a stick down the hole, you can tell where it came from. Well, instead of come from over here, Rocket Ridge, it came from North Vietnam. And so while we were shooting that way, they were pounding us coming the other way. So that was the first incident that we had that changed my attitude.
I can see how that would get your attention. And you said something there, you know, you got hit in the back and you thought you were getting killed. Did that like knock you off your feet? Is that what you're saying?
It knocked me forward. And the guy behind me, Dick Munn, he went the opposite way. He went backwards. Mm-hmm. So we were that close together.
So you pick yourself up, and from what it feels like, you expect to find all kinds of stuff in your back and bleeding and all that?
Yeah, but I reached back, and I was told by others after that there was nothing there. There was some dirt marks. And so I got down a gun 4. We fired off a couple of rounds. And like normally happens, you shoot a couple of rounds back, and they stop shooting at you because they go back down in their hole. And
so if I'm interpreting your comments correctly, it sounds like you're saying you didn't feel quite as invincible after that?
I didn't feel quite as invincible after that. But then from then on, then as things happen and we get encounters with the North Vietnamese or whoever was out there, we start picking up KIAs and that, and you think you're really winning that war. So then it was probably the first part of January, there's going to be an operation called Lam Sum 719 to intercept and do away with the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so there, that was planned, and I knew something was up, but I didn't know what it was. And so all of a sudden, we're told we're going to Laos.
If you know your history, you probably know American ground forces were prohibited by law from crossing that border into Laos. But that doesn't mean that Jean Guillou and the rest of the men in the 8th of the 4th couldn't go right up to that border. That's exactly what they did, and there were consequences. It's time for our final break, but we'll hear the rest of his story when we come back. March 29th is National Vietnam War Veterans Day, so make sure to thank and honor the Vietnam vets in your life. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode preparing you to say welcome home to Vietnam vets in your life. National Vietnam War Veterans Day is March 29th. That's a relatively new commemoration established in 2017, but Jean Guillou was telling us about February 1971 when, as a fire direction controlman with the 8th Battalion of the 4th Artillery, he was sent over to the Laotian border to try to neutralize the Ho Chi Minh Trail as part of Operation Lam Son 719.
If you can imagine, there's probably 100,000 Vietnamese plus American support heading down this Highway 9, which is a past Camp Carroll turned into a dirt road, and we're going to the Laotian border. And then probably, second night, whatever, as we're traveling down Highway 9, Charlie Battery was behind A Battery, B Battery, and Battalion, and so we lost the rest of the battery. So we pull off on some ravine to the south of Highway 9, spend the night. The next morning, we get back on the road and going down Highway West on Highway 9 trying to catch them, and we wind up being told somewhere along that, well, you're not going to be with your other batteries. You're going to become part of this other one, which was the 4th of the 92nd Artillery. So I get to the Laotian border, and all of a sudden, instead of four guns, we got eight guns. Four brand new ones they had been in Da Nang, and they had brand new carriages, brand new tubes, and we had four beat up old carriages, but nice tubes. And so now I'm chief of section of fire direction control, and I got eight guns instead of four. But we had our batteries FDC reporting to their battalion FDC. And so me and another guy are kind of sleeping in a kind of a little crater in the ground when all of a sudden a hellacious explosion goes off. And we're being fired at with Russian artillery, either 152 or 156 millimeter, whatever. And I go rushing over to FDC, and they're not doing anything, and I ask why, and he says, because their method of operation is when they're fired upon, they don't fire back. They let someone else fire. Well, that's a Crocker. And so we get permission. We fired toward them. They were on the other side in Laos, and we're shooting at the wrong target because we see the smoke on the ridge, but really they were on a small secondary ridge behind that. And I tell you that because I was told by someone in a helicopter that that was the case. Mm. And back to FDC and back down to Gun 4. And before I got there, there was a large explosion, and we had two of our cannoneers got killed. Mm. That was February 4th, 1971.
These were guys you knew pretty well.
I was very, very close with Gun 4. Before I got there, and another guy before me, there was very little communication between fire direction control and the people on the gun. But we kind of changed it. Even I was used to go down there and hump projectile. These things weigh 208 pounds just for exercise and to help them out. So I had a couple friends on that gun. I know today because when we went as a group to the Vietnam Memorial, their names, and we also have a memorial at Fort Sill with all their names on it. And
what were those two guys' names?
L. Fulton and Blake Whitney. Like I say, we have a memorial, those two and the two that died when I told you the first one I first got there, which was August 25th, 1970.
How do you handle that? And I know that's a loaded question that might have different answers for different days of your life since, but at that time, maybe you can help us understand how you tried to handle it then and how maybe you've learned to handle it or deal with it over time.
I probably never fully deal with it. When we were on the Laotian border and after the two guys were killed, I didn't remember anything for about 3 months. And I remember that we pulled back to some valley on the west side of Khe Sanh, and I remember something about, you know, things flying over us, but they did not use us for fire much, if at all. Mm. And so we just kind of sat there for a month and a half before we worked our way back to Kantian. And like I say, I don't remember probably for 2 months in my brain what had happened then in the year 2000. And I'm out in the yard doing something. And I get a phone call that someone says, "Were I in Vietnam?" I go, "Yes." When you were in Vietnam, did you have the name Gopher? And like, you know, the guy, I hadn't heard that in a long time. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You remember a guy by the name of Stinky?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." And they said, "Well, I'm Stinky." And after records in the service, after 30 years, they become unclassified. So we had guys that were very good and they were still in the military or working for the government at finding people. Well, after 30 years, your orders become unclassified. And if you can get a hold of them without the Social Security numbers marked out, it was very easy for us to find people. And out of 1,800 people that served in the 8th of the 4th, we found over 700. We have a reunion every 2 years at Fort Sill, where we all trained. 2 years later, we're east of the Mississippi. 2 years after that, we're west of the Mississippi, and then we go back to Fort Sill. When we're on Fort Sill, we go to Lawton. We go on base with the troops that are training.
What do those reunions do for you? What do you get out of it?
Well, I get a lot out of them. They tell me things that I don't remember about Vietnam that I should have remembered, and they're very healing, and you know, and I look forward to them. My wife, who came to all of them but the last two, she learns about stuff about me that, you know, I don't even remember.
You know, you told me about the day that gun took a direct hit and you lost two of your friends, and you told me their names. When something like that happens, is part of your thought process, hey, that could happen to me?
It wasn't up until then. You know, we had taken hits before and minor, besides the first day I got in battery. I thought I was invincible. I thought that could not happen to me. And until we went to the Laotian border, because of, I don't know if I mentioned, we didn't get much news from the rear, and my folks were not good at communicating to me of stuff that was happening back here, like Kent State and the rest of it. So I actually thought, and the Stars and Stripes, were they weren't going to tell us anything. And so I actually thought, you know, well, this war is going to end in our favor. And then we're going to the Laotian border. We're going to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then all of a sudden, one day, that completely changed. Basically, it was defeat to me. And I really did not, my thought process did not have a way of handling that. So I guess that's why everything kind of shut down as far as memory.
Yeah, and I know none of this is easy to talk about, but I'm curious, and I'm sure there's other guys out there listening who can identify with what you're talking about. Over these last 50 years since you left Vietnam and tried to get on with life, you were on the boat for a while, you said, and then, you know, an engineer with PG&E. How has that time in Vietnam affected the rest of your life, and how have you kind of processed it over the years? Are there some things you found to help?
I'd say, yeah, Army training helped a lot in dealing with people and different people and work, you know, people in the physical forces and that. I always thought I was good at that and maybe did some of my additional development into that area. And that's why, even though I was an engineer at PG&E, I also did a lot of work in the operations department as a water foreman in Burney, maintenance supervisor in Auburn, and hydro superintendent on the Feather River. And then they had slated me to go to Helms to be a full-time hydro superintendent. My wife didn't want to have our daughter being raised in the country, you know, an hour bus ride each way to school. So that's when I decided operations wasn't for me.
You mentioned going to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., seeing those names. For someone, you know, listening who didn't go through what you went through and who hasn't felt that, can you help us understand what that's like when you see the names of guys you served with, you were there when they died, and you see their names on that wall?
At first, I thought I would have a hard time even looking at Fulton and Whitney's names, but you go there and you take a penciling of it, you know, and then you kind of carry it with you, and it just makes you feel better. And there's another one too, and he and most people that were there with me, his name was Stu Buckley, and he was the battery commander, and his name, he got fragged by one of the people at Charlie Battery to see his name there also. He was a great guy, didn't do nothing wrong. Out of the clear blue eyes, somebody threw a hand grenade into his hutch, and yeah.
You know, I don't want to be cliche or melodramatic, but is it ever a thought in your mind when you see their names on the wall or you just think about their memories? Do you ever say, hey, I think Fulton or Whitney or Buckley would have done XYZ with his life? Do you ever imagine what they might have done had they lived as long as you have?
Until I went back to reunion and talked to other people and this organization here, the Vietnam Veterans of Diablo Valley, and you see people that have come back with major medical problems and major injuries, and you just stop and think, you know, that could have been me, and what would happen if I'd have come back that way, and my family, and or in that case then I didn't have a family, I didn't meet my wife till 1975, so it probably, but yeah, I do. I've got clips, and there's CBS. There was a newsman when we were out on the Laotian border, and he was doing a story about there was some general or somebody that was trying to enforce people getting haircuts. And, you know, I look, and then one of them is, it's either our A battery or C battery, and in that clip he mentions that his sister battery had two people killed, and you know, just to watch that, I wouldn't call it sickening, but it's very saddening.
Well, and if there's anything else that you want to include, please feel free. I just want to make sure I say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for talking about something that isn't always easy to talk about. I don't know if this is an easy question to answer or not, but when it comes to the guys that you just mentioned, and the 58,000 other names that are on that wall. How should we remember them today? What's the significance of their sacrifice?
It's just, it could have been. You know, I was very fortunate it wasn't me. They were not fortunate it was them. And I just happy to be where I'm at and thank God every day.
Vietnam veteran Jean Guillo of Santa Cruz, California, one of approximately 850,000 living Vietnam War veterans that we honor, along with those no longer with us, on March 29th with National Vietnam War Veterans Day. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded again by our veterans, regardless of when or where they served, of something they all understand more deeply than the rest of us ever could. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.